I've already done it 10 times, come on. You barely glanced at it. Shut up and let me work. Her dad had been a guy you could settle down with after work and knock back a few drinks. In fact, Mike had wanted to bring him into the trust. It was too dangerous, though. For some years it had been obvious that the Greys couldn't read minds well, not normal minds. But Eamon's mind was a different story, like hers. They had to be kept strictly unaware of any secret the Greys shouldn't know. Although the daybed appeared empty, Laura knew that Adam was lying on it. She had learned to see him in her imagination, even though his tiny movements, synchronized to her flickering eyes, prevented her from observing him in detail. Mike wanted her to be careful, so she'd be careful. She formed a thought series this time. First a picture of a map of the state of Kentucky, then a vision of the satellite image of the event in the field behind the Oak Road houses. Nothing came back. She formed another thought. React, Adam. She called up a sense of urgency, stared, tensed her muscles. There exploded into her mind an image that at first seemed to make no sense. She was looking up at a towering immense wall of ice, ghostly white and iridescent blue against a deep blue sky. And then she heard a sound, a gigantic snapping noise that combined with a strange sort of sigh as if 1,000 people had simultaneously gasped. She was on the upper deck of a cruise ship. They were glacier watching. The deck was jammed with people, and the ice was curving slowly over them, bringing with it a shadow that turned the bright afternoon an eerie, glowing blue. The ship's huge horn began to sound, thundering again and again. The whole body of the vessel shuddered as it strove to get underway, the propellers churning, smoke gushing from the stacks. With a boom to wake the dead, a gigantic boulder of ice, an ice mountain, slammed down on the foredeck. The whole ship lurched violently upward and forward. Water, clear and frigid, surged over the bounding deck, and the passengers were hurled screaming into the waves. Lauren looked up again and saw dropping toward them an even greater mountain of ice. An eternity of ice. She was back in the cage. She asked Adam a question with her mind, felt the question in her heart. What does it mean? Then she saw a supermarket. Bright lights. Voices bellowed. A little girl toddled past with a tin of sardines. A man swooped down, grabbed it, knocking the child aside. Screams came, merging with the bouncy shopping music. People clawed for bread, raced down long, empty aisles, hollow people, their eyes wild, ripping open boxes of uncooked pasta, gobbling it, throwing back raw oatmeal, eating from the mashed garbage on the floor. Gunshots. Soldiers in dirty uniforms, tired young faces, terrified eyes, shot into the crowd. And people just sat there, staring like a dumb animal stares who has no idea what's about to happen. As they got shot, they crashed back with astonishing force into a shattered freezer, and then the soldiers passed down another aisle.
What's going on in there?
I don't know. He's showing me some sort of tragedy.
What?
Ship sinking. People starving in a supermarket.
Christ, will you get me what I need?
Damn you, Mike. What I am gonna get you is what I always get you. I am gonna get you what he has to give. Because Adam was showing Lauren images of the coming extinction, he might be aware of the conversation Mike had been listening to, which made continuing this way too dangerous.
Okay, that's it. Come out. We're done.
I love my baby, she whispered, getting up from the Barca lounger. She reached out, touched the cool, soft skin of a hand that only became visible when she held it, the narrow fingers and lethal black claws fading when she withdrew. Adam shot back an image of a mother nursing an infant, his standard goodbye. As she got up, he made one of his audible sounds, a cry like a shocked and despairing woman. Did he feel anything? She didn't know. But she did know that he was trying for sympathetic attention. Adam, I know you have a message for me connected with all these disasters, and I know I'm not getting it. However, we're asking you about a specific incident, and... She got no response from him. She knew why. He'd heard the words. But unless you formed your thoughts in your mind, he didn't understand you.
Lauren, break it off!
Mike? Sir?
Lauren, there's no time!
No time? What the hell was he talking about? She had all the time in the world. and God knew Adam had time. I'm going to get this thing rolling.
There is no time.
But Adam had different ideas. Adam's mind was all around her. She could feel it. She closed her eyes, took a deep breath, and let herself go blank. He came into her as always, like a dog sniffing for a buried bone. Letting him get inside her felt kind of good, but also oddly sad. A sadness that he brought with him. He would go into her memories and kind of troll there, bringing up all sorts of things from her past. Things she'd just as soon have forgotten. Stuff done when drunk, that sort of stuff. He liked the intense things. Sort of ate them, she thought. She let him go deep into a familiar little corner. The cardboard box experience when she was about 10. One of the first things she'd ever done that was related to sex. She smelled the slightly damp cardboard box again. Saw Willie Seaver's plump, white body. Felt his hand go under her blouse. And then shut that door with a great crash. She shot her question at Adam, the satellite image again, the town of Wilton, the houses on Oak Road. For a split of an instant she thought she glimpsed a boy's face, but it was not Willie Seaver's. Curly hair, slightly chunky, looked about 14 or 15. "I have something," she said. "A face."
"What sort of a face?"
"A kid. I asked him about Oak Road and I got the face of a kid."
"Bring it out."
Mike was all over her the moment the door closed.
"Got what? What did you get?"
"They're interested in a child."
"Say more."
"He's a boy of 14 or 15, curly hair. And another thing, I glimpsed a dog. He has a dog." Mike became furtive.
"Okay," he said. "That makes no sense."
"Yes, it does. They're interested in this kid."
"Probably some kind of breeding issue. We'll never figure it out. You're dismissed. Operation complete."
He was lying, and he was scared, and she was suspicious. "What's the deal with this child?"
"Look, I have to go to Washington, and I'm already late. You're done, Lauren. Thank you."
She watched him leave. The one pleasant thing about her relationship with him was knowing that he wanted her, and denying him. She did it because, well, she didn't like him. Just did not like the man. She was not nice to him, couldn't be. Why, she thought, had something to do with Adam. Adam seemed suspicious of him somehow, wary. "What's going on, Andy?" she asked as she came into the control room still drying her hair.
"The boss is sure as hell in a lather."
She went topside, and when the elevator doors opened, found Mike just leaving. He was in full uniform, which was pretty unusual around here. He had his briefcase in his hand. "You're moving fast," she said.
"Yep."
"Are you going to do something to that child, Mike?"
"Look, this is not your issue. Your issue is to communicate with Adam, and to take that job one hell of a lot more seriously than you do."
"How dare you?"
"How dare me? You're the one with pictures on the walls down in that hellhole. That thing is a predator. It's a monster. It's not a damn pet, for God's sake, woman."
She made a decision. He was going to Washington. Fine. She was coming back here and going at it again with Adam. She would get to the bottom of this without Mike around, because if this child was in some kind of danger due to her report, then she had a very clear moral duty. No matter the legal blockade her clearance created, she had to protect the kid. She would not be a party to murder, and she would not follow orders that she considered to be illegal. She watched Mike hurry out to the parking lot and take off in his latest car, a brand new VW Phaeton. She knew the value of that car. She'd looked it up. He'd just driven off in half a year's pay. Where his real money came from, she didn't know. But it sure as hell was not the United States Air Force. Ten. The sun peeking over the Warner's roof woke Caitlin. As usual, she rolled over, at first feeling entirely normal. She considered turning on the news. And then it hit her. She was upstairs in bed, not in Connor's room where she had gone to sleep. Dan chose that moment to slide an arm over her. Caitlin leaped away from him as if his body was on fire. Hey. Connor. She ran downstairs, ran across the kitchen, took his stairs three at a time and burst in. When she saw that the door to the outside was open, she stifled a cry. But the lump in the bed seemed entirely normal. She knelt beside him and peeked into the covers. Connor was deeply asleep. She kissed his freckled cheek, inhaling the milky, sour smell of his skin. Dan came in, went over, and closed the door that led out under the deck and into the backyard. Look, he said. There was a puddle of water on the floor in front of it, standing on the linoleum. And outside, in the sparse grass that clung to life under the deck, were numerous small holes. They looked for all the world as if somebody had walked there on stilts. She went to Dan, looked down at the water, out at the peculiar holes. This was not right. None of this should be here. She rushed back to Connor, drew down his covers. Again she kissed him. She pulled him into her arms. Connor moaned, then suddenly stiffened. Mom? He said. Kneeling beside the bed, she held his face in her hands and looked into his eyes. He asked, What's the matter? She hugged him to her, feeling the heft of him against her. Her boy was on the verge of becoming a young man, and he was so beautiful. And you had to be so very careful not to let him know how beautiful you thought he was. Could you guys let me get dressed here? The little boy who had cheerfully laid naked in her lap just a few short years ago now did not want to get out from under the covers in her presence, not even wearing pajamas. She kissed his cheek. 6 months to your first shave, she said. Mom predicts. The sooner the better. He looked at her. She looked back at him. He moved his eyes toward the door. Breakfast in 10 minutes. She and Dan went upstairs. What was that about? Dan asked as she closed the door. She whispered, It's about his growing maturity. Problems controlling what's up down below. You think? Puberty? Bright kids reach it early, so it says in the book. As they mounted the stairs, she saw the Connor Zone sign in his recycling bag and took it out. The Connor Zone was so cute, she said. Cute is the problem, Dan said. Part of it. The other part is being too smart in a world that glorifies the lowest common denominator. Connor's intelligence is not fashionable, and it's too big for him to conceal. Oh, I never want him to do that. How's your ear, by the way? Not actually okay. I could stand to get an X-ray. You're kidding. On your ear? Well, there's something there. Something there. She reached up and touched the outer edge of the ear. It's a little sort of a knot. I know what it is. Relax, Dan. I'm not the enemy. For the past half hour, the smell of coffee had been getting stronger, and she went into the kitchen and poured them both mugs. Dan took his over to the table. She went into the pantry and got Connor's latest cereal, some kind of amaranth flakes thing. Connor had his own dietary ideas, most of them pretty smart and pretty awful. He was a modified vegetarian, except when Dan grilled steaks. Then he was a sullen but voracious carnivore. There was no cancer of the ear, was there? Connor appeared, poured himself coffee. She waited to see if he put the required amount of half and half in it. Did. But just a drop. Eggs? She asked as she turned on the skillet. I'm going to be eating really pure for a while, Connor said. No dairy, no alcohol. You don't drink alcohol, Dan said. Better not. I mean no wine with dinner. Wine belongs to the soul, son. No man can be fully himself without wine. The other kids can't drink it. Which is why they'll all be binging like the college students in a few years. Did you know that binge drinking among the young is unheard of in Europe, but common here and in the UK? What does that tell you? Children have to learn wine early, get used to it, which is why you'll continue with a glass of wine at dinner, thank you. I love the irony. Most kids would do anything to drink even so much as a sip, but I don't want to, so it's forced on me. Well, you get a glass, one glass, which is mandatory. Do you want to have the fight now or schedule it for later? Because I will not be drinking wine. Dan sighed. I've got to go to the health center to get my ear amputated. Let's do it when I get back. He picked up Connor's cereal box. I saw this lying open in the pantry last night. Are roach eggs okay for vegans? Connor took the box, poured himself some cereal. Amaranth is one of a handful of dicots which photosynthesize directly to a four-carbon compound.
Ah.
So the reason you're now eating nothing but horrible-looking little crumbs is explained. You want that four-carbon compound.
Actually, I want the protein and the lysine without meat, plus I get a designer-quality lipid fraction.
I have the cholesterol readings of a 12-year-old, you know.
You're 11.
It's a joke, Dad.
Ah, of course.
Caitlin put down her and Dan's eggs and sat at the head of the table.
May I know the why of the vegan thing?
The aliens. A silence fell, extended. Are you about to piss me off? Dan asked.
I am eating pure because this neighborhood is in a close encounter situation, and it's the eating of animals that triggers the kind of fear response I experienced last night. I don't want to fear the aliens. I want to face them.
Oh, boy, Caitlin said.
Dan?
No, I understand that I'm being baited. It's not a big deal, Caitlin. He watched Connor digging into the amaranth, and as he watched, he got angrier and angrier. He was being baited, damn right. Connor was masterful at it, and here he'd been the confidant, the father confessor, just yesterday. Now he was the enemy, and his ear hurt like hell, to tell the truth. And he really did not need this just now. We had a visit from the Greys, and they had an abductee aboard the craft, and the Keltons probably have video, a first in history. The world is changing, lady and gentleman, and I am preparing myself.
What Greys? Dan asked carefully.
Try googling Grey alien sometime. You'll find more than 4,000 references. Plus this business of UFO descending with a screaming woman inside happened in Kentucky before. Moorhead, 2003. Same situation with one difference. No video. Lots of 911 calls, but no video, and therefore no story. The sanctimonious sing-song, the eyebrows raised to make the face appear absurdly credulous. It was all calculated to infuriate. Connor knew perfectly well how ridiculous Dan considered the whole UFO alien folklore to be, and how damaging to the culture.
God damn it, it was nothing but some kind of dope-inspired prank.
Dad, please, you're embarrassing yourself. Dan's hand had slammed down on the table before he could stop it.
Connor seized the opportunity.
Right. Go physical yet again, Dad. It'll make a juicy story for my psychiatrist to be. Another one. Dan had spanked Connor exactly one time when, at the age of 3, he had rewired the toaster and caused a dangerous fire in the wall of the kitchen. It had been a single sharp blow to the left buttock, which had been thrown back at him perhaps 10,000 times since.
Connor, listen to me.
I'm up for tenure, which the entire college knows. It's terribly important to us. If I don't get it, I have to resign, which means that we have to move on to some other college where Mom and I both can get work, and she has to give up her own tenure here. It'll be a mess, son. And something like this, a UFO in the backyard, can ruin my chances. Marcy Cotton already wants to write me off, so please, for me, do not say anything about us seeing it for at least another few weeks.
Connor gazed off into the middle distance.
Prediction. The Kelton's tape, if it is halfway decent, will make this place famous.
Prediction.
Dr. Jeffers will make a total idiot of himself about it, and he'll end up with walking papers.
Prediction.
You will not be damaged by this, but Dr. Cotton will still screw you to the wall.
Every time Connor used the word prediction, a chill went right through Dan. Their son was never wrong.
Actually, he found that he was so on edge and Connor sounded so right that he almost burst into tears and was instantly appalled at himself. How could he possibly react like that? That wasn't him. But then he thought, the pressure of the tenure conference coming up, the bizarre events in the night, the sleeplessness, Caitlin's waking up in near hysterics, this damned lump in his ear. Of course he was on edge, stressed, big time.
Look, he said.
Thanks for a perfectly delicious breakfast. Tomorrow's my turn, and it's waffles unless there are objections. He looked down at the still gobbling Connor.
I'll make yours without egg.
Fine. They'll be fascinating. I'm going to the health center. I'll call you with a verdict.
Prediction, Connor said.
They will find a small object enclosed in a membrane made of cutaneous tissue. And if you search your body, you will find an indentation where that tissue was taken from. It's called a witch's mark. He smiled up at Dan. The Greys have been with us for some time. Connor, this happened last night in a kitchen full of people. I hardly think the Greys could have operated on me without anybody noticing. There was a moment, probably just a few seconds, when you were all turned off. The Greys did what they did and turned you back on as they left. It's called missing time. It's the way they handle us. We're their property, you know. You know what the great anomalous Charles Fort called the world? A barnyard. The Greys are the farmers. And right now they're doing a little farm work right here on Oak Road. Okay, I'll bite. What are they doing? For one thing, they've got some kind of a plan for you, which is why they gave you that implant. You're involved, Dad. Let's look, Caitlin said. I want to see this thing for myself. But Dan did not want them to look at it. He retreated upstairs and took his shower. Safe in the stall, shaving and soaping himself up, he felt his body for the sort of indentation Connor had described. Nah, there wasn't one. They'd x-ray him at the health center and tell him what he already knew. He had a cyst that was mildly infected. The doctor would prescribe a couple of weeks of an antibiotic, and if it got worse, he'd go in and open the damn thing up. He had to wash his hair anyway, so he sat down on Caitlin's shower chair that she used for shaving her comely legs and, well, what the hell, he felt along both ears and across the back of his neck. There was nothing there, thank you, Connor. It's so delightful the two or three times a year that you're wrong. As he stood back up, though, he felt a very slight soreness in his right buttock. He felt back there just above the cheek. As his fingers ran along the smooth, wet skin, he knew. He felt again to be sure. Then he was having an aura, one of those odd sequences of perceptions, in his case a vision of stars all around him from his childhood planetarium, followed by a feeling of floating. They were the prelude to one of the seizures like he'd had in childhood. He leaned up against the side of the shower. Caitlin, he managed to say, not yell it, couldn't do that. Caitlin! The feeling of floating got stronger. It was uncanny. He even looked down to be sure his feet were still touching the floor of the stall. Then his eyes fixed on the drain, the silver circle of it with the water swirling down. The drain became larger and darker, and now what he saw was a round black hole in a field of gleaming silver. Objectively, deep within himself, he knew that he was seizing. He felt nothing. You never did. All he could see was this opening that had been below him but was now above him, black and foreboding, getting bigger. It was like being drawn into the underside of a gigantic silver balloon. That was how the seizure affected his temporal lobe. Then it was gone. Bam. The shower was back, drumming on him. He coughed, gagged, recovered himself. Quickly he rinsed his body, got out of the shower, and dropped down, still soaking wet, onto the toilet. Jesus God, he'd seized. After all these years, he had damn well seized. In his late childhood, when the seizures had first been diagnosed, he'd been put on Dilantin. He had tolerated it well, and maybe he'd better go back on it. He hadn't had actual spasms while in the shower, or he would have gone down, so he was still dealing with a petite mal epilepsy. That was on the good side. On the bad side, for this to return after so many years suggested that there could be some other syndrome present. For example, maybe there had been epileptiform tissue in his brain that had developed a tumor. Maybe the thing in his ear was indeed a tumor. It would not be a primary. That did not happen to earlobes. It would be metastasis of a hidden primary, asymptomatic until it began last night to press a nerve. If this was a distal metastasis of a brain tumor, he might well be a dying man. He toweled himself and dressed fast. He went downstairs and through the kitchen again where Caitlin and Connor were still breakfasting. Connor now absorbed in NPR on the radio, Meet the Press on TV, and the New York Times Week in Review, while Caitlin read the funnies in the Herald Leader. "Zitz is great," she said as he headed out to the garage. "The father gets this later. I'll call. Be sure they're open." If they weren't, he was heading to the Wilton City Hospital emergency room. There was no way he could make it through another night without knowing what this thing was. In the event, the health center was open and staffed by a nurse and a squeaky little doctor who appeared to be just a hair older than Connor. He was tempted to head on to Wilton anyway, but his paranoia was running full blast and he feared a note to Marcy from some tenure inquisitor. Subject refused treatment at College HC, preferred Wilton. Listen to that thinking, though. Paranoid. He was having seizures for the first time in over 20 years, and now entertaining lunatic paranoid fantasies. But how could he ask this freckled little boy with a sunburned skier's nose for what he really needed, which was a damn Xanax strip to take home with him? Doctor, I have a little cyst in my left ear that's giving me trouble. Mild trouble, but it's waking me up at night when I lie on my side. He sat on the edge of the examining table while the doctor, if that's actually what he was, gently examined the ear. I'm assuming a subcutaneous infection, Dan said, aware of his own nervousness. He wanted to also say that he'd seized, but he dared not do that. Paranoid delusions aside, if that got back to Marcy, it might indeed have implications. There's a mass, the young doctor said. Dan felt the blood drain out of his face, felt his heart turn over. He was 40. He was dying. Let's do an X-ray, the doctor said. He followed him back into the green-tiled, Lysol-scented depths of the health center. Dan managed to get enough spit up to talk. What do you expect to find? He asked mechanically. Have you been doing any sort of carpentry? Carpentry? There's a mass in there with something hard in it. I'm thinking a nail head. Something along those lines. Can you see a point of entry? Not anymore. When did it start hurting? Last night. That part of the ear's not very sensitive. It could have been there for a while, just recently become irritated. They reached the X-ray room and the doctor turned on the lights, which flickered to life, revealing the same X-ray machine that had been there for all the years Dan had been involved with Bell College. Probably war surplus, and not from a recent war. The doctor took 4 views of his ear, and then he was sent off to the waiting area. An extraordinarily bleak little room, with an anorexic gray couch against one wall, 3 plastic chairs, and 2 chair desks for students who might wish to study while waiting for their bad news. Dan would have taken out his iPod and listened to the New York Times, but his iPod was on his bedside. His choices were a coverless copy of Bicycling, or the front half of a not very recent Newsweek. Half an hour later, he began to fear that the young doctor, upon seeing the X-rays, had leaped into his car and rushed off to Wilton with them. He went back into the depth of the place where he found him sitting in a tiny office, studying a thick textbook. "Oh, hi," he said. "Let's see if that email's come in yet."
"Email?"
"Yeah. Your X-ray's being read by our radiologist. He got it online." Now that was somewhat reassuring. A high-powered radiologist at another institution was reading his film. "Here it is." He opened an email. "Boy, these guys need their English translated into English."
"You can't read medical terminology?"
"I can't read a Sri Lankan's idea of medical terminology. Your radiologist is in Trincomalee. Actually sounds rather romantic. Trincomalee."
Dear heaven.
He reached across his desk and pulled out an X-ray folder. "This is interesting," he said. He put 2 of the X-rays up on a wall light. "You have a foreign object in your ear," he said, "as I suspected." Dan stared at the X-ray. The object was a tiny pinpoint of light. He could hear Connor's precise young voice. "They will find a small object," he asked. "Is it enclosed in a membrane?"
"A membrane? Not likely. Maybe a little calcification if it's been there for a while. I think it's a metal filing.
It could have migrated from anywhere. I have a sore place on my buttock.
Let's take a look."
He lowered his trousers. "Nothing visible, perhaps a slight indentation is all." Once again, Connor had been exactly right. "So what should I be doing about this?"
"If it bothers you, I can take it out."
"You?" He laughed a little. "Quite easily. It's not deep. It'll take 5 minutes. He lay on the examining table and let the nurse swab his ear with iodine. They injected him a couple of times and went in.
"Feel anything?"
"No."
"Okay, here it is. It's a white disc. Whoa."
"What?"
"It just went...
What the hell?"
"What?"
"I'm withdrawing."
"Did you get it?"
He was silent as he took a stitch in the wound. "I did not get it," he said at last. "I got a little sliver of it before it migrated. It's down in your earlobe now." He felt the lobe. "How can that be?" "I'm not sure. It's not a normal object." He had to say the word, hard as it was. "Cancer?" The doctor laughed. "Cancers don't generally run like hell when you touch them with a scalpel." "Was it, a living thing, then?" "Dr. Callahan, I have no idea what it was. But I'm going to do two things to put that question to rest. First, I'm going to put this sliver under a microscope. Then I'm going to send it to the lab." "Does this happen to people often?" "First one I've seen. Foreign objects are a whole subdiscipline of trauma medicine. It's nothing to worry about, though. I wouldn't think twice about it." They went into another room, this one containing a lab bench with a fairly decent microscope on it. The doctor prepared a specimen slide and put it into the viewing area. He lowered his face to the binocular. Dan watched him, waiting. He lifted his head. "Okay, off it goes to pathology." "But what did you see?" "White material, probably some sort of a protein." "Why did it move? Is it a parasite?" "Lord, no. Here, take a look for yourself." Gratefully, Dan looked into the microscope. What he saw was shaped like a sickle of moon, and along the curved outer edge there was what looked like movement. "What am I seeing? It's still moving, am I right? That has to be a light effect." Dan adjusted the scope. Clearly the thing had cilia on it, and the cilia were propelling it. He lifted his face. "Cilia," he said, "look." The doctor barely glanced at it. "Well, call day after tomorrow, we'll give you the pathology report." "But it has cilia on it that are moving. So it's a living thing, it must be, and it can migrate. What if it goes somewhere else, into my brain or my heart?" "There are no ear parasites like this." And that ended that. Another two patients had come in, and the doctor was off to attend to their hangovers. On the way home, Dan called and told Caitlin that he was fine. She asked him what they'd found, and he came quite unexpectedly to a powerful personal moment. He found himself shaking so intensely that he pulled over to the side of the road. "Dan?" "Sorry. It was a little something in there. They took it out." "What sort of a little something, honey?" "Not a tumor." He found that he very much did not want to tell her that Connor had been right. He did not want Connor to be right, and he never, ever wanted to ask Connor how he had known. "It was a little cyst. Took 10 minutes to get rid of it. The main delay involved waiting for the radiologist to evaluate it in Trincomalee. It seems we outsource our diagnostics to experts in the third world. Or is it the fourth world? Is there a fourth world?"
"You sound a bit out of it."
"It's been a long 24 hours, dear. I'm coming home and I'm going to turn on the TV and watch Sunday golf and spend the afternoon in a coma." All the way home, without knowing why and without being able to stop, he cried. There was no sound. In fact, his expression never changed, except for wetness flowing down his cheeks. He felt like an idiot. He never cried. But he couldn't stop himself now, because a tremendous sorrow was coming up from his depths, a hidden river exposed. He remembered this so well, this anguish that he could not control. It had been a feature of his childhood, had come after his seizures.